This is an interview with James Warren, formerly vice chairman of the Board of Trustees of the State University of New York, at his home in Albany. So I'm trying to get recollections. Why don't you start about as soon as you think there's anything that's you want to.
The first mention of Stony Brook was the year before I went to the university, 1956.
I see.
The legislators on Long Island were demanding something be done about higher education on Long Island.
Uh-huh. Was that the Carling?
Carlino, I would suspect, was one of the leaders in that at the time.
I see.
And so I didn't, wasn't in the background of the first came on, but before they even got underway, I was on the board then in 1957. Mm-hmm. I went on in November 57.
How do you know that, how did Ward Melville hear that something was going on? I understand a letter of offering some land in Stony Brook came out of the blue. Did he know Frank Moore?
Well, I think he knew not only Frank Moore, I think he knew most of the Republican politicians down on the island.
Yes.
And Ward Melville was one, I think he was the first chairman of the council then.
That's right.
And he offered the land. And unfortunately, he tied into that offer that he was going to have something to say about what type of building was going to be put on the campus.
Is that in the letter or?
I don't know what was in the letter or what it was, but we were committed to go along. There were specified the type of roofs and the height of the building and things like that that he was going to, because he gave that land. It was so restrictive on it that I, as a personally, he said that I would never accept a gift of it for the university that had any strings attached to it, because that cost us a great deal of money to try to build it in conformity with Ward Melville's idea of what it should be. I mean, he wanted to have the quaint little village down there in Stony Brook, and he didn't want anyone to keep the college the same way.
I see. But apparently went ahead and accepted it.
And he accepted it. It would have been a lot cheaper if we took it by condemnation proceedings.
Yes, right. Let's see. Harriman was he was governor then.
Harriman was governor. He became governor in 54 and stayed governor through 58.
Right.
So really, when the construction got underway, Rockefeller was the governor.
Yeah. By 60.
But Rockefeller took over as governor in January 59. He was elected in 58.
I see.
Became governor in 59.
Do you know who brought in Heald to give the Heald report?
And Rockefeller did.
Rockefeller did.
Mm-hmm. Henry Heald. Trying to think who else was on his commission.
Well, I know that Tickton probably wrote the report. But who else was on the commission, I don't know. But it mentions Stony Brook specifically as an institution to stand with the finest in the country as a concept.
Yes, I think it was at that point when the decision was made that Stony Brook was going to be one of the four university centers of the university.
Who made that decision? When was it made? Did the trustees make it?
I'd say the trustees made the decision.
Yeah.
But I they were probably, the Hill report carried a lot of weight because it strengthened the trustees of the university. Mm-hmm. Prior to that Hill report, the trustees, and this has nothing to do with Stony Brook,
no.
The trustees of the university were under the Department of Education.
I know, Dewey had gotten the legislation to take them out from under the Associate Commissioner for Higher Education and give them their own Board of Trustees and their own executive officer, but they were still under the regents in that sense.
In the sense that they were, when the university was created in 48, the state had 21 departments, mm-hmm. and it could not create another department without a constitutional amendment.
Oh, really?
I never knew that. This is true, see. In fact, we tried to get that amended through the last time the Constitutional Convention was held, mm-hmm. I forget how many years ago. But that was the constitutional program was all defeated in the election, and it was not changed. The Constitution wasn't amended at all in that, after a series of it. But because they could not put it in a new department in the state, it had to be incorporated into one of the other departments. For instance, when parole started, it was incorporated into the executive department. When we started in 1954, the Department of Aging, it was in the executive department. Afterwards, transferred to the Social Welfare Department. Mm-hmm. Parole always remained part of it. Sylvie, get out. Come on. Get. Go on, it's down. Down. Hurry up. Always
up. I guess she's going all right.
So that even if in the early days, if the Albany campus presented a budget to us in the State University, the trustees, we could approve it. But then it had to be moved up to the Education Department. They would present it to the Department of Budget. Now, that was created because, number one, the Education Department never wanted the State University.
Why not? They were in public education.
But they weren't. They were dominated completely by the private colleges of the state of New York. The regents were completely oriented to the private colleges of the state of New York and committed to them. So that in 1948, to get the first budget of the state university passed, the trustees and the president and the governor had to agree with the legislature that they would not establish a single liberal arts college for the first 10 years of its existence. So that from 48 to 58, we could not even change one of the teacher colleges into a liberal arts college. We could build all the two-year community colleges we wanted. We could establish and move ahead with the medical colleges, but we could not establish and create a single liberal arts college. That was because the regents never wanted it. The regents insisted that the head of this new university system be called a director. And in the legislation that was set up that way, in the last minute of the legislature, Norm Hurd and a couple of legislators changed that word director to president.
Is that right? So we owe that to Norm Hurd.
It got through as president because I think Norm saw the ridiculousness of even saying president, but that was as far as they could go. So now they had a president with 20-some other presidents under.
Yeah.
It wasn't at the Hill Commission that we were able, after the Hill report, we were able to change that title to Chancellor. It was the Hill report that said it was ridiculous for the state university to have to go through the regents and be approved by everything in the regents and the Department of Education any more than any other college did. Right. So at that point, we started to be able to deal directly with the governor and directly with the budget office ourselves. But it was after the Healey report that was really enabling us to do that. I think Rockefeller realized when he appointed Henry Heal how Henry Heal would feel about it. He picked the right man for the job.
He was, wasn't he, president of the Ford Foundation then?
One of the, I don't know whether it was Ford or not.
I think it was Ford.
It probably was. That was just before George Bundy became president. I think it was, that's right. But that's how everything had to be approved by the Department of Education. And there were very bad feelings between the trustees and the Board of Regents. They were antagonists. It took many years to smooth that out and try to get a working relationship with each other.
Frank Moore was able to do it, was he?
I think it was smoothed out with Frank Moore. He recognized the idea that we ought to be working together. But it was after I came on. Now the university was going 10 years, almost 9 years before I came on. And then I was on it a couple of years before we straightened that mess out with the Regents.
What about Allen's point of view?
I think Jim was one of the ones that helped straighten it out. I think Jim was receptive to a good public university system, more so than his Board of Regents were. I think Jim was had to walk a tight line there with crossing his board up to support us and so on and so on. But we did make progress in that. But I know that we one time had an agreement with the Board of Regents. We had a liaison committee. And it was when we were preparing for this constitutional convention coming up. So our trustees met with four regents and the chancellor and the commissioner of education. And there was supposed to be no staff or anybody else there. And we met with them every 2 months. We would host a dinner and they would come, and then they would host a dinner and we would go to their dinner. And Jim Allen, we got the regents to agree that we ought to have a separate department. But when they came right down to it, they worked behind our back to make sure they were killing us. They did not want that, and it's never changed. Technically, we're still in the education department today. And, which is a ridiculous situation. It'd be like saying, well, let North Star Bank control all the banks of the state of New York.
Well, now, from the standpoint of those on Long Island, we look back at our own history and we see that initially it was started as an institution to train teachers for mathematics and science.
Right.
And there was also engineering in there, but very little was said about engineering.
Well, you see, that was 60 was the time that science was taken over in the educational field, if you recall. When was Sputnik?
I think it was 57.
Yeah, but that created a desire to create science, institutions of science and technology,
right.
And there was bypassing the arts. There was no question about that. There was great desire on the part of the people on Long Island with the political leadership, and there was no place in the world that politics played more or interfered more with education
than Long Island. I see.
We had the strongest political machine in the country here in Albany. Yet Rastus Corning would never question what was happening on the Albany campus. He was interested, but he would never say, who are you going to appoint president, or I'd like to see so-and-so president, or anything else. Yet on Long Island, the politicians interfered all the time. They got to the council members, and they even right down to the terrible situation with Alec Pond. It was the politicians on Long Island that were playing that game. So they were the ones that were looking for science and technology. And I can remember there was great talk with General Electric Company at the time. And General Electric Company wanted to set up a very broad general science and engineering program. They wanted no specific, like mechanical engineer or electrical engineer. They wanted a very general program. They said, well, we want these people, we want them educated when they come to us, educated in the basics. Come to us, we'll train them the way we want for our institution. Yeah. I recall meeting with them at that time.
Was there any meeting with people from Bell Labs, to your knowledge?
I don't know. I really don't know. But I would suspect there was. Mm-hmm. I would suspect there was.
Now, who took the initiative there in setting up the engineering curriculum? Leonard Olson, the dean on the campus there, was a philosopher from Chicago.
Right. He went down there on a temporary basis.
Well, that was not until, I think, not until 61. Not until after Lee had left.
No, let's see. Yeah, that's right. Lee was appointed in 59. No. Lee was appointed in 60, and he left in 61.
Yeah.
He was I have a note here that he was interviewed in September of 1960 by our board.
I see.
And he was fired in November of 61.
Yeah. Do you know why?
I know the details of it, but he was problems from the day he went there. Administratively, he had no control over it. Administrator, you have no control over the thing. Let me see. 61.
I wonder why he didn't have control.
In November, this is a report of the president to the Board of Trustees. President Hamlin stated he wished to review again with the board a series of dissatisfactions with the performance of John F. Lee as president of Long Island Center. Dr. Hamlin said questions as to the competence of Mr. Lee for his responsibility had risen from time to time soon after the effective date of his appointment in January 61. He was only there 11 months or less. He recalled for the board that after a series of incidents last spring, Mr. Lee had requested further opportunity to demonstrate his capacity to cope successfully with the administrative problems along Long Island Center, and that he had acquiesced. He said another series of circumstances had now occurred that made it evident that the best interest of Long Island Center and State University could not be served by further continuation of Mr. Lee's services as president. the president said he had completely lost confidence in Mr. Lee's administration, and after careful consideration, he had reluctantly concluded that he must recommend the removal of Mr. Lee as president of Long Island's Center on Terminated Services. He said this decision had previously been discussed with members of the Council of Long Island Center. He had given Mr. Lee an opportunity to submit his resignation. With the agreement, he would be assigned to another duties until the end of the academic year. He reported that Mr. Lee now publicly rejected this opportunity, but he was placed in a recommendation of termination of Mr. Lee's services before the board for his action. And he was removed. The board passed a resolution that day to remove him. Now, 20-something years yesterday, but I don't recall all the details.
Right.
There were just one thing after another. I mean, each month there was a problem with Stony Brook.
You had a dean there who had Leonard Olson had been the person assigned to get things started.
Right.
And his background was in philosophy from Chicago, which was a divisionally organized institution. That is, the curriculum was by divisions. And then you have him recommending Lee, if I understand it, to be president. But Lee was an engineer with a departmental background. And my experience with philosophers and engineers from Bucknell is that they are poles apart in their approach to things.
Right. But don't forget that in those days, it was very difficult for the university to attract top people into the state university. You had no prestige.
Right.
You were young, you didn't have anything going for you. Huh?
That's right.
We didn't have any, Tom Hamilton himself at the time was a very fairly young man that came out of a vice president of Michigan.
Yeah.
Tom never got control of the university. Why,
You know why not?
Yeah, the university went through a period of a few presidents. I mean, Al York.
Yeah.
He was the first president and so on and so forth. Then Bill Carlson was president. Now, Bill Carlson afterwards went out to Indiana, I think it was, and was there for, was it Indiana?
I've forgotten whether that was or Chicago.
That was Indiana, I'm pretty sure it was
Indiana.
And he was there for quite a few years. What happened with Bill Carlson, and I'd only met Bill Carlson for a period 2 months before he resigned. The board asked Bill Carlson to hire somebody, some consultant, to tell us how to, and this was before I went on the board, how to establish a good research program in the university. And he hired this fellow named Blagett. Now, as I found out afterwards, nobody on the board ever met this fellow. Frank Moore met him one day walking through Grand Central Station. He was with Bill Carlson. Mm-hmm. And Carlson introduced him to this fellow who was making this research project. And the first thing you know, this Blagan report came out. It had nothing to do with research, but had recommended that they give up all the units of the university and establish a single unit in the university on Long Island.
Single unit on Long Island?
A single unit on Long Island. Take all these 11 teacher colleges and tie it all into one and create a big university out on Long Island. That was released to the press without the Board of Trustees ever seeing it. The governor, I understand, called up Frank Moore and raised hell. And Frank said, I don't know anything about it. I never saw it either, see.
Yeah.
Well, I was appointed by the governor 2 days before this came out. The governor then said, I want you to meet with the president of the university. He had a wrong conception of Harriman. Harriman's idea was, I was his man on the university board. And I remember he announced that when I was appointed. And when I was sworn in, well, I remember talking to Frank Moore in between time and saying to Frank, look, I'm coming on your board, but I'm not coming on to play politics, no matter what you hear.
Right.
And so the governor's secretary, assistant secretary, Milt Stewart, called up Bill Carlson. The afternoon the governor said he was appointing me and arranged for swearing-in ceremonies and all. Called up Bill Carlson and said, Bill, he said, I got your boss here in my office. Oh, gee, you know, stupid. And I want you to have lunch with him and talk over the university, because this is the governor's man going on the university board, and he's going to represent the governor and all. See, with a embarrassing situation. So there was a date made.
This was meaning you.
Meaning me. Yeah. See, I'm only a trustee, you know what I mean?
Sure.
So there was a date made on the telephone, and I was to meet Bill Carlson like 3 days after, 4 days afterwards. In the meantime, between 1 or 2 days after I was appointed and before I got there, this Blagan report came out. You know, there was murder in the papers about it.
Yeah.
I can remember saying to Bill Carlson at lunch that day, what's all this furor about this? And I said, yes, it's just quite a stir in cause. And he said, sometimes if you want to get things done, you have to stir up a hornet's nest. And I said, yeah, I think that's probably true, but lots of times you get stung when you do it. I remember saying this to him. Now, that was in November. My first board meeting was in December, the week or two after this poor report came out. It was a terrible board meeting to go to. You know, the trustees were up in arms. They were being blamed for this. They had nothing to do with this program. They really blasted Carlson that day. It was terrible. I was embarrassed, and I was new in the situation. I didn't know hardly any of them well. I knew Frank Moore from being around here, but most of the trustees I didn't know. And it was really an unhappy meeting to be at. So that the December meeting, they always used to meet in New York at that time. And the January meeting, around 7 o'clock in the morning, Bill Carlson called me up. I was staying in the Biltmore Hotel at the time. And he asked me to have breakfast with him, and I went down to breakfast. I realized afterwards that I was probably the only trustee he could talk to because I wasn't involved in the thing. And he announced he was going to resign. And I said, well, from the tone of the last meeting, Bill, if I didn't want to resign, I wouldn't offer my resignation. Because I'm sure that you offer that resignation is going to be picked up immediately. So all I'm saying is, if you don't want to resign, don't throw that out as a gesture, because they're going to pick it up immediately. So they did, actually, and they said, you know, they asked him to leave the room afterwards, and he decided that he was resigned, but he would have nothing to say at the university from that minute on. He could stay till August. I'd give him something to do to keep him on until August, so he wouldn't hurt him professionally. And his assistant, who was writing all the stories and speeches that he made, was a fellow named Dan Button, who afterwards was a congressman in this area for a term, and then was a editor of the Capital newspapers for a while, and now is back in Albany as a fundraiser. The board insisted that Dan Button had to go at that minute. He was fired. Because Carlson then was going around the state criticizing the trustees, the governor, and the regents for not supporting the bond issue, which passed overwhelmingly to raise $250,000 to start the university. And they were, you know, the governor and the regents were really supporting it. But Carlson was going around saying they weren't, and it was embarrassing to everybody involved. So Carlson was out, and he was then, in the meantime, he was out in 57, and Tom Hamilton wasn't, Tom Hamilton was a wasn't appointed until May 59. So in those 2 years, they technically had three people running the university. They appointed John Slocum, who was dean of four-year colleges, Herman Cooper, who was dean of the teacher colleges, and Larry Jarvie, who was dean of the community college. And they were supposed to run. Well, they each run their own ballet. But the truth of the story was, is that Frank Moore, as chairman of the board, was calling the shots. He was calling the shots.
He was his own executive officer.
Yeah, he was. Now, you know, because they had three, they really needed somebody to be calling it. But, you know, he'd be better off if one person was made it and not the chairman of the board. But it went on for 2 years that way. Frank was calling the shots. Now, Frank was a hard worker for the university, and he was a great supporter of the university and did a lot. I mean, he never got all the credit that he deserved. I got like much more credit when I retired than Frank Poor ever did, and yet Frank did an awful lot of work to get it started.
When now, were you made vice chairman?
In 65.
65.
Yeah. I was vice chairman for 17 years.